TV Land. Hello here.
How do you make your food like this?
Welcome. Thanks for coming. We're very pleased to have Anna Yancey and Rob Menenga. They're going to talk to us about exemptions, the outlines, and there's multiple ones with a lot of good information, are posted on the website, so go check that out under the Lou Jones Breakfast tab, of course. In the outline areas, please don't forget to send in your CLE forms to Paula so that we can get you signed up for your CLE credits. Next month, August 14th is our date. We're going to have a discussion on pretrial practices. And it will be led by Nathan De La Durante, Heidi Miller, Melissa Blair, and Jack Zaharopoulos. So come on back next month for a discussion on pretrial practices. We have December, of course, lined up for ethics, our annual ethics presentation to grab that credit, ethics credit. That's in December. We are going to skip and not have a meeting in September. We will not be having a meeting in September. And we are looking for topics for October and November. So if you have ideas, if you have questions about a certain area, you think an area is something that we should all discuss here, talk to Ron Blake. He's our coordinator this year. Again, thanks a lot to Hannah and Rob on exemptions. Take it away.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. Go ahead.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. So as Judge already said, my name is Hannah and this is Rob, and we're talking about exemptions today. And basically, we just kind of looked on, you know, the biker listserv, what topics were coming up for that, what kind of questions did we have in coming across cases that we've had that were a little bit difficult. We had some suggestions from Ryan as well as what we should bring up today. So that's what we're going over today, just kind of things that had popped up. If anyone has any questions or anything that's come up as well, bring that up to the end, because we have a lot of people here and a lot of ideas where we could hopefully find a solution for you.
And also bear in mind that this is coming from the standpoint of debtor's attorneys, so I'm sure that trustees or creditor's attorneys might have different viewpoints or also different practices with their clients as well. So please bear that in mind, that we might be a little bit biased on the side of the debtors here.
No,
but, you know, that happens.
So exemptions, why do we have exemptions? Public policy, debtors need the basics to live. We need to be able to have a standpoint where the debtors are able to get back on their feet. We don't want them to fully have nothing left over. I always explain to my clients, you're allowed to have some stuff, but not a lot of stuff. And then I usually explain, you don't have that much stuff, so you'll be fine, basically. we'll talk about it a little bit later, but there's a specific time or a window of opportunity to claim your exemptions, because you're not allowed to file your case and then months and months later say, oh, we actually have this whole life insurance policy with a cash surrender value, let's exempt it now, or what have you. We just have some definitions below, just some things that had come up. Under Section 541, you know, what kind of things are property of the state? Well, of course, we have the interest of the debtor, anything legal or equitable. We also have anything that's under the sole control of the debtor. We have any interest that the trustee could recover. We also have any interest that the debtor could be entitled to come across. That's the part that I put in here, because sometimes we can forget to remind our clients that even though you don't have it now, something that could come up within 6 months after you file your case, it's still going to be an asset of the bankruptcy case. So that's something that I put in here because I thought that was important. And then under 522, definitions of under the exemptions portion of the code is what is dependent, what is the value, things like that.
So I guess I'll start out with one of the outlines that I prepared here on the timing for exemptions and which scheme to use. Bear in mind that this is Section 522 of the code. It's a very important section, especially as far as debtors' attorneys are concerned, and for bankruptcy and exemption planning. So the time limits that you're going to want to look at are, like I said, under Section 522, and which scheme you want to use is also very important. There are plenty of online resources, and I would strongly suggest that you bookmark some sort of exemption website that lets you know which state allows for what exemption. And getting into that, Section B1 or subsection B1 of Section 522 is what allows the debtors to choose either the federal or their state exemptions. The subsection B1 also specifically says, and I'm sure this has come up either through mistakes when you've prepared your petition for your client or just simply out of not knowing, but there is no mixing of subsections B2 and B3. So you can't take the state homestead exemption along with the wildcard exemption from the federal, as nice as that would be. It's specifically forbidden by the code. Subsection B2 is what allows debtors to take the federal exemptions, and those are listed out in subsection D. But the most important section, at least in subsection B, is B3, A, B, and C, as that is what allows the debtor to choose from their state and gives the states the option to opt out of the federal exemptions. If I recall correctly, 37 states actually do opt out of allowing federal exemptions right now. So that puts Wisconsin in the minority, as in this state we can choose to use either federal or state exemption schemes. Now, the important dates to remember are 730 days and 180 days. First off, for filing a case, you have to be a resident of the state for the majority of the 180 days prior to filing the petition. Most of us don't have a problem with determining that. Basically, just ask your debtor, you know, how long have you lived here? And if they just moved into town, you're going to want to wait before filing the case so that you actually can file here. But usually that's not a problem. Now, where you really need to pay special attention is for the 730 days. So a debtor must use the exemption scheme laid out by the state that they've lived in for the 730 days immediately prior to the filing of the bankruptcy case. If a debtor has lived in, you know, Milwaukee for all of their life, it's not a problem. You get the choice between state and federal. However, if within the last 730 days, which if you do the math is the last 2 years, if they've moved around it, or if they have not lived in this one state for the last 2 years, that's when the number 180 comes in. Now, you don't simply take where they've lived at the longest for the last 730 days, and that is what you use. Rather, I'm not entirely certain why it was chosen this way. However, you look past that 730 days. And you have to go to the state that they lived in for the 180 days prior to that 730 days. So if they lived in the state of Illinois, as in the case that I laid out here, in Ray George, for the majority of the 180 days prior to the 730 days prior to the case, then you must use the state exemption scheme from that state. And just briefly, I want to talk about the case of In Re George, which is a Judge Kelly decision here. So the debtor filed here in the state of Wisconsin, but had not lived here for the last 2 years prior to filing. In fact, she had lived in Illinois, from what I could glean from the case, for many years prior to that. Given that she had not lived in Wisconsin for the last 2 years, the attorney had to look back and see that she had lived in Illinois for the 180 days prior to the 730 days prior to the filing of the case. And I keep repeating that because that's important. It's not the 180 days prior to filing the case. It's the 180 days prior to the 730 days prior to filing the case. And this is important because we must know that you have to use the state's exemption scheme, not the state's exemption laws. The trustee had objected to the exemptions on the ground that the debtor, who had chosen to use federal exemptions, should have used Illinois state exemptions. That being the case, the debtor would have been unable to exempt one of her vehicles which then would have become an unexempt asset of the state, of the estate, and the trustee would have been able to liquidate that and give some money to creditors. Since the debtor was not a resident of Illinois at the time of filing, however, she was unable to use the state's exemptions. You have to look to the exact wording of the statutes. Most states, in what I've seen, have a specific sentence that says that residents of this state are allowed to take the state exemptions. So in looking at the code, it was seen that, or in looking at the Illinois code, the debtor was not able to use Illinois exemptions because she was not a resident of the state of Illinois for the 180 days prior to the filing of the case, had to file in the state of Wisconsin. But because the state of Illinois specifically said that the exemptions for the state of Illinois are for residents of that state, the debtor was able to choose federal exemptions. Now, that comes in from the hanging paragraph after section 522B3C. If the debtor had not been able to choose the Illinois exemptions, as she was not, she would not have been able to choose Wisconsin state scheme because she was not a resident of Wisconsin for the 730 days prior to the filing of the case. The hanging paragraph states that if a debtor would be ineligible for any exemptions, then they are allowed to take federal exemptions. In this case, the important part of this to remember is that the bankruptcy code does not state that a debtor must use a certain state's exemptions, but rather a state's exemption laws. So I guess the important part about timing and what exemption scheme to use is remember the numbers. Remember that in section 522 sub B, it sets out whether you can take the federal or the state's exemptions. Then you have to look to your state's code and see what exemptions are allowed. And you go from there if your debtor is unable to choose any exemption scheme, then you can choose federal.
I just would point out that after I wrote that George decision, Judge Klingenberger over in Indiana had the exact same facts, a debtor who moved from Illinois to Indiana. And he, the trustee, objected to the use of the federal exemptions, and he came out the other way and said, you can't use the federal exemptions, you're limited to the state exemptions, and he disagreed with the George case. Now, within the last couple, 3 months, and maybe somebody in Madison knows the name of the case, Judge Martin had the opportunity to do the same issue. And he had George, and he had Judge Klingenberger's case, and of course, he followed George. he did agree that with the analysis there.
I admire close friends. Okay. So, matter of fact, have you ever seen that 3-volume? Oops.
Okay.
That 3-volume set, Ginsburg and Martin.
Right. They might have cited that 3-volume set, Ginsburg and Martin, on bankruptcy. Okay. So that, just so you know, if you're wondering whether Judge Martin adopts the same reasoning, he does, but it isn't the same everywhere, so you got to kind of watch it. There is some argument for the trustee's position that an Illinois person who moves from Illinois should be limited, and as I recall, their state exemptions are pretty...
pretty bare.
They're pretty limited. They are pretty limited.
That's what I was looking for.
Yeah. So you want to make sure that for debtors' attorneys, when your client comes in, you got to get specific information. You want to know exactly where they live. Not only do you have to include it on the statement of financial affairs, their past addresses for the past 3 years, I think it is, but you also want to know for what exemption schemes to use. It's important when you are deciding what exemption scheme to use. Again, in the state of Wisconsin, we do have the luxury of choosing either the state's exemption scheme, which are mostly laid out under Chapter 815 in our state code, or Section B22 or 522B4, which lay out the federal schemes. And one of the things that, I often do is you want to look at what assets they have. Different states offer different exemptions, and depending on what assets they have, you may choose a different exemption scheme. Since
do you have a rule of thumb that you use, Rob? Like, if they have a house, you use Wisconsin?
Well, it really depends.
And
if they have a house.
If they don't have a house, you use federal because of the wild card?
If they have a house with a lot of equity, then yes, you're going to want to use the exemption scheme, or the state exemption scheme, because, and actually just relatively recently, Wisconsin increased the allowable exemption scheme for the homestead exemption. Actually, several years ago, I would have said if they have a lot of equity in the house, you're going to want to use the federal because that exempts actually more. However, now in the state of Wisconsin, given the amount that you can exempt for homestead, if they have a lot of equity in the home, we generally choose state exemptions. However, yeah, if they don't own a home, we almost always go with federal because of the wild card exemption, and you can throw anything under the sun for the most part under that wild card exemption. But yeah, equity is really where it matters in the house.
Yeah, I would agree with that. When I do have that random client or the rare client where they do have too much of something, I usually say, well, if you have too much equity in a home, you have a couple four-wheelers, which one do you choose? Mm. Usually they're going to choose the home. And I say, well, okay, then you're going to have to prepare yourself because we're not going to be able to protect those four-wheelers under the state exemptions. We're going to use the state exemptions to exempt the home because people need a place to live. And under Wisconsin, I mean, we really can't exempt random things like a four-wheeler, a couple four-wheelers. So sometimes in those cases, maybe we'll do a Chapter 13. If there's several, I had a client where he had a skidster, I believe is the correct term, and he said it was not in great condition, but yet it was still worth like $15,000. So he wanted to do a Chapter 13, protect his Harley and his skidster so that he can keep his assets and go that route. Other clients, of course, want to do a Chapter 7.
It's a skid steer.
Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Chapter 12 trustee over there is not. No.
Yes.
Skid steer.
Yes.
That's where we see those.
Yeah.
I have no idea what that is, so I'm going to defer to your knowledge. Do your knowledge on that?
Or lack thereof.
Yeah.
Or a Chapter 7, if they choose to go that way, because usually that's the better route, then we'll say, okay, we're going to make a deal with the trustee at that point, because we can't exempt the non-exempt asset. So I think it's funny when Rob was talking about how when you move to another state, if you're not within that 730 and 180 days of just the one state where you have to use the federal exemptions, I think it's funny because we usually use default exemptions are the federal. We usually use that as a default. So I find that funny how they're like, oh, here's your punishment. Use the federal. Well, I think that's great. So okay, so... So just back to the outline where that I was talking on before, we're under Section 4, just under this heading of which one do you use, Wisconsin, or do you use federal exemptions? Like I mentioned and Rob mentioned, states can opt out of the federal, but I put there under B2, that's my default. I usually go right to the federal. And so when I'm doing my consultation with people who first come in, I automatically assume I'm going to be using the federal, but if something comes up, that's when you know, the red flags come up about the too much equity in a home or maybe too much equity in a rental property. So now let's think, are you able to move into that rental property? Can we wait to file your case, you know, months down the road for you to establish your residency at that rental property versus the home that you live in if there's no equity in that? Because then you'd be able to keep both homes if you're able to maintain mortgages. You know, things like that, that's... those are definitely things I think about when a client comes into the office. What kind of equity do they have? How much equity do they have? Most of my clients, and I'm sure a lot of your clients as well, just don't have much equity in anything nowadays. It's quite rare. But we'll be talking about valuations as we go along. Did you want to talk about a different topic, or should I just go into class?
Go for it.
Okay,
go
so Section 5, let's talk about classification of assets, mostly Schedule B. So what kind of things do we want to be putting on there? What do we want to be thinking about? So basically, debtors get the benefit of the doubt. So whatever is listed on the schedules is what's going to be approved, you know, negative notice. So if anyone objects, then there will be hearings on that. But otherwise, the schedules are what they are. Now, what we want to make sure to do is not to delay, hinder, or defraud a creditor, right? And I have on here, pigs get fed, hogs get slaughtered. So we don't want to basically take too much. We don't want to have too much listed. We don't want to make it look like we have all these assets, but they're worth nothing at all, because that's not true. I always have clients come in my office and they own a home, or even if they're renting but they have several children, they say, well, I own nothing. Well, I know that's not true. We have to list your household items. We have to list cookware. We have to list bedroom sets. What are you sleeping on? A mat on the floor? I know that's not true. So to them, they don't have anything at all, but we do have to list your items. We have to list that you have these items. Yes, I know at a garage sale, it's not going to be very much of a value. Whenever I have garage sales, I always charge less than a dollar for everything. I understand that you could sell your probably everything in your house for a couple hundred dollars at that rate. But the trustee is not going to believe us if we don't list something on the paperwork. So I always make the trustee out as the bad guy, no offense. But
not me, you guys are great.
So I say the trustee won't accept this. We need to put something down. So once I have that heart-to-heart with them, then they're more likely to fill out my sheet the way that I want them to fill it out, so that I can put that into the computer. So I have a couple cases here of just exhibiting, you know, that In re Copeland, the site for that is 156 BR 88. It's from 1993, where debtors had lived in Wisconsin. They had a home with a lot of equity. They sold it, and they had cash. They moved to Florida, and within a year of moving to Florida, they filed for bankruptcy. Well, in that time frame, they bought a new home, and Florida has a large exemption for the homestead. And in this case, the court saw that it was too coincidental that they decided to sell the home in Wisconsin that also had a lot of equity that would not have normally been exempt in Florida. So they sold the home, they moved to Florida, bought a new house, which now could be exempt because there's a lot of equity in that house based on the sale of the Wisconsin home. And they were limited to the federal exemptions in that one. They could not use the entire Florida unlimited homestead for that one. Again, pigs get fed, hogs get slaughtered. In re Reed, the site for that is 12BR41 from Texas, 1981. So this is an older case. I just thought it was interesting because this guy's company's name was Triple BS. So that didn't help.
Asking for trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
And his initials weren't BS.
No, they weren't.
That's the key.
Right. The Fifth Circuit held that the debtor who converts non-exempt assets to exempt homestead immediately before a bankruptcy with the intent to defraud creditors should be denied a discharge. So what happened with this guy? Well, this guy had a lot of assets that would not have normally been exempt under the state laws. So he sold those assets, and he then used that cash to pay on his mortgage because he was able to exempt his home. Well, as I mentioned here, good faith is lacking. So the court denied his discharge in that case because there were a lot of transactions in a short amount of time right before the bankruptcy was filed, within a couple months before the bankruptcy was filed, where he sold a bunch of things and then used it to pay on his mortgage, which would be exempt. Okay, so valuation. So how do we value? We have the liquidation value, we have the retail, we have the wholesale, we have fair market value. For me, usually with clients who come to my office, I will use NADA if the vehicle has a lien on it, and especially if I'm in a Chapter 13. In a Chapter 7, sometimes I put on there what the debtors believe the value is, because a lot of times if the car is paid in full, it's a number of years old, there's a lot of things wrong with it, like it's not running. So then it's not going to be the NADA value. So I also list on here the trustee versus the debtor versus the creditor opinion of the asset value. That's important. Keep that in mind. Of course, as the debtor's attorney, I want to keep the value of the asset as low as I can, because if I'm using the wild card exemption for a number of things, a four-wheeler and a second car for, let's say, a single filer, I want to make sure that I can fit a couple things under that wild card exemption. The trustee or the creditor, on the other hand, wants it to be a higher value. Number one, if it's not exempt, they want to be able to believe that they can sell it for something else. Or if we want to make a deal, they can get more money from the debtor because it's not exempt. So what do we do? Well, in this day and age, we are able to get appraisals because the value of things, especially homes and things like that, are not as high as it used to be. So I always tell my clients, go to Shore West or go to some realtor that you can get it done for free. Or CarMax, I believe it does. They do free value or valuations of vehicles and things like that. Sometimes a KBB printout or something online, or I had a Kenmore semi truck, which when I looked at it on Google was worth like $100,000. And his valuation from a reputable source was $12,000. So that's kind of a big deal. That's why I don't do the valuations for my clients, because I don't have the information that they do and what type of vehicle it is.
Well, plus you also want to provide the trustee, and if it comes down to it, to the judges, with some sort of proof of what the value is. I have done it before where a motorcycle, now frankly, I'm not a motorcycle guy, I don't know the value of motorcycles, and I believe it was, I don't remember offhand, it was down in Kenosha, went to eBay Motors, and I looked at what had sold this motorcycle, what that exact model of motorcycle, pardon me, had sold for in the last 30 days or whatever, and provided four auction numbers to the trustee with that to provide the value of it. So you really want to have proof, because if it comes down to it, you don't want to be scrambling later on to provide the judges or the trustee with some kind of proof. You want to go into the Section 341 meeting knowing what it is. And I'll let you continue here, because you said
that leads right into description. Personally, I like to list on my Schedule B what the asset is, whether there's a lien against it or not, and what the value is and how I got to that value. So, 2007 Chrysler PT Cruiser with 90,000 miles, lien held by Landmark, value according to NADA, or paid in full, value according to debtor, not running. So I always list exactly what the vehicle is, because I believe the more information the better, the less work the trustee has to do, the less questions that they will ask of me and of my debtors as well. Usually the my debtors and I have talked about it to a point where the trustee will say, is it really worth, or what do you believe that it's worth, and my debtor will actually testify to what is listed on the schedules, because they honestly believe that vehicle is only worth $2,000 or what have you. I just think that just is a great way to go into the 341, like Rob mentioned, with everything laid out on the table. That kind of also leads into business valuations. I don't have this on the outline, but after I typed it up, I thought, well, it's a good thing to mention as well, because the trustees want to know as well, how do you value that business? They want to know what the assets are, if there's any liens or loans, or any SBA loans encumbering the asset, are there any accounts receivable, how about any taxes owed? Because really, the valuation of a business is the assets versus the liability. So what is the net of that? And if you're, there's something I was reading online where this debtor was testifying that his business is worth $100,000. Well, let's think about that, because we can't exempt that. So let's say how many liens are against, or how much do you owe to your creditors? And how much are your assets really if you could sell them off? And how many loans do you have against? Do you owe taxes? Most people who own businesses do owe taxes. So they're not thinking about that kind of thing. They're just thinking about what goes in their pocket or what goes into the till at the end of the day. So I just find that that helps to put on Schedule B and SOFA as well, what your business is actually valued at. Because again, the more I have listed on the schedules, the less the trustee will ask. Yeah.
How do you deal with the sole proprietor who thinks that he has an independent business that has separate value from his own estate, but obviously it's all him?
So how do we deal with the sole proprietor, and how do we list it basically in the schedules? I ask as many questions as possible, and I try and make sure that I have a good idea, because sometimes a sole provider is based upon the person's knowledge. So is that what you're going to say?
No, I think that's kind of what he was getting at there.
Oh, okay.
When the value of the business is the person.
Right. And then if the trustee were to wind it down or sell it to somebody else, what is the actual value of that business? It's not worth as much anymore. Because what if, let's take our profession. We have a single attorney with the shingle out their door. Well, now you sell it to somebody else who doesn't know as much or isn't as skilled in that profession. It's not going to be worth as much, for sure. As far as how you list that, I would say that the measure of the profit or the goodwill of that company is not is based upon that person, because it comes from the knowledge of that person. And I guess I would just leave it at that, or I would describe, you know, this, the debtor is a sole shareholder or the sole provider. He doesn't have any employees except if needed throughout the year, and I guess I would let the trustee ask a couple questions if they needed to. I would think that that would be self-explanatory, but you know, the trustee may ask a couple questions just to round out what I've listed.
And frankly, when it comes to valuation of things, a lot of a debtor's attorney's job is to, we're counselors. We're counseling our clients, and in some cases, a debtor might think that, hey, listen, my business is worth a lot of money, because to them it is worth a lot, and in their head they would like to think that it's worth a lot more than it is, and it's our job to really sit them down and try to, you know, show reality to them a little bit more that, yeah, you are valuable to your business, but your business itself isn't terribly valuable without you in it. If the trustee is going to sell that business, what can he sell? It's been a long time, and thank goodness, you know, joking around here, but it's been a long time since we were able to sell people along with a business. And I think that it needs to be pointed out to some debtors that, you know, that we're looking at what value can go to your creditors. That's what the trustee is interested in. This, in reality, your business is not worth as much as you think it is. And that's, you know, as a debtor's attorney, we want to... It's nice to have a lower value on things so that we can exempt everything. And that's not to say to make things up or to lie or to obfuscate anything, but you gotta work with your clients and meet with them and talk to them and convince them about true valuation.
And I think that's really important, because 30 to 45 days later is the 341. Well, if the client isn't convinced of what we talked about in my office, they're not going to testify the way I want them to. So they're going to testify the way that they originally thought in the beginning. So there has to be some kind of a dialogue and some kind of a meeting of the minds, if you will, to what we write on the paperwork. So I always have them tell me my story. I type it in, and then I read it back to them. And I say, do you agree with that? Is there anything I need to add or subtract from what I just read to you? And usually at that point, they say, it sounds fine. And if I'm the one who goes to the 341, I'll say, okay, so now we're going in here. The trustee's going to ask us a lot of questions, as you've already heard, because they've been sitting there for a while. Do you remember what we talked about? This is what we talked about. Do you, you know, I just want to refresh their memory. We're going into the 341. So usually I can do that if I'm the one who's there. If not, then I hope that the work that I did in the office is good enough for them to testify truthfully at the 341.
You're talking about dealing with people who have overinflated.
Yes.
Ideas of value.
Yes.
What about those that are trying to be sneaky, and you know, how do you deal with them? And you know, when I, it's many years ago now, but when I did some debtor work, I tried to tell them that if you've got an ex-wife out there, or you've got an ex-business partner out there, or if you got anybody mad at you out there, you're not going to get away with this. You have to be realistic. I don't know what your experiences are and thoughts are, how to find those people so that you don't end up getting your own reputation.
Right.
Yeah. Well,
connected with them, and how to deal with them and get them to be honest with their creditors and the trustee to get this relief.
That goes back to being a counselor to your client and pounding home the truth that, you know, the truth is more important, and I can help you out a lot more if you tell me the truth and you see things realistically than I can if something comes up at the 341 meeting and I didn't know about it and I had no way of knowing about it, and all of a sudden, hey, guess what? We're talking to the UST, we're talking to the judge. You know, like I tell them, listen, be realistic about it. I can't help you if you're not going to tell me the truth about these things. And frankly, it's important in your first meeting with a client to find these things out and to know when not to take a client if they're going to insist on lying or hiding things. And that's selfish. I mean, that's just me being selfish and offering selfish advice, but you don't want to get in trouble. This is our profession. This is our livelihood. You know, we don't want to get in trouble, and we don't want to earn a reputation, as you said, for showing up in court every time we have a debtor with a business and trying to say, oh, well, you know, this inventory, it's not actually worth as much as you think it might be, even though there's proof that it is. And
well, you have to explain to them that the value, yes, it's valuable to you, but we have to value things from the standpoint of the creditors, which is if you've got a service business, that's your hard assets.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
of course, your hard assets are not nearly as valuable as you are, but you aren't up for sale.
Right.
I also had a client one time tell me, well, nobody would ever know I had this coin collection under my bed.
I do.
That's true.
And at which point I said, oh, well, you know, if you're willing to commit fraud, then vistas of opportunity open up before you. But you'll just have to do it with another lawyer.
Yeah.
And that usually brings them around.
I said almost that exact same thing to a debtor one time, and I talked to Trustee Grossman about it when we were having hearings down in Racine about someone who was hiding, I think it was 8 Rolexes and a couple BMWs or something like that. I don't remember the exact number, who said to me, well, I'm not going to tell anybody about that. And after continually telling him, we can't do that. I can help you try to protect this stuff. We'll go into a Chapter 13. We're not going to be able to do a Chapter 7. We'll go into a Chapter 13. We'll write up a payment plan and, you know, was not willing to do it. I said, well, I can't help you. Please leave my office. Because it got to the point where it was getting belligerent almost. And I think that his ex-wife did show up at a 341 meeting, and that stuff came out. And I don't know. We, you know, I just mentioned, I don't know
it's
what ever happened.
It's a perennial topic at Jack's Ethics in December,
mm-hmm.
when
yeah.
you've thrown one of these jokers out of your office, yeah. and then you're at a 341 meeting with someone else, and there you see them.
Right.
Yeah.
And what is your responsibility to drop the dime? I mean.
Yeah, yeah, and
right.
we'll let him talk about that in December.
Stay tuned. Come back.
Yeah, exactly.
There's one asset that I see missed frequently with businesses, sole proprietors, whatever, is their receivables. They don't recognize that as
mm-hmm.
an asset.
Mm-hmm.
Medical professionals often have significant insurance and government receivables. They just don't think of that as an asset.
Sure.
It's often.
Do you want to repeat that in case they didn't catch that on the video?
So Trustee Grossman said that something that usually comes up as a missed asset, probably comes out in the 341 meeting, is the accounts receivable. A lot of medical professionals have, now correct me if I'm wrong, they have a medical asset or they have some kind of an account receivable through their
insurance receivables.
That they don't think of as an asset for the business. So she would just like to politely remind everyone, friendly reminder to list that.
They take a long time, but they're very collectible.
Okay.
And tax refunds. I don't know if you were going to hit some of these unusual ones, but we do see the Chapter 7 trustees coming, glomming those tax refunds at certain times of the year.
Right. I mean, I should have
just don't
when they're worth pursuing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I should have mentioned that before when you're picking Wisconsin versus federal. I mentioned the house for sure, but tax refunds, if you have a house that has a lot of equity and you also are expecting a $10,000 tax refund, I usually have to present it. Let's wait a few months.
Yeah.
Or if you must file now, if you have a garnishment, and you want to file now, or there's something going on, you're getting married or you're getting divorced or something, we have to file now, well, you'll have to choose. And usually the client will begrudgingly choose the home because that's where they live. But yeah, we will usually mm-hmm. want to go with federal because then you can protect your state tax refunds then. And remember, it's only what you actually have yet to receive. Because sometimes we'll list on our schedules that they have yet to receive it, but they actually did, or vice versa, that the client told me that they already got it. Well, they mean that they already submitted it to the IRS and the state, but they haven't actually received it yet. So once in a while that does happen where the client actually did not receive it by the time we filed the case when there's problems.
A case to kind of speed things up here, because I know we don't have a whole lot of time. In Ray Myers, which is mentioned on Hannah's outline here, under how late is it to list something and exempt something, that goes to Rule 1009. But it's also a good point that, we favor the debtor in terms of allowing exemptions, not really favor them, but give them the benefit of the doubt. However, read In Re Myers. It's a good decision, but it's also warning to you to look into these things, like the tax refunds, because although Judge Kelly, you know, believed the claim of the attorney in that was representing the debtor in Ray Myers, she stated in the opinion that she is, you know, going to be wary of claims of inadvertence. It's important to do your homework beforehand, especially after hearing us talk here and me warning you to read In Re Myers. She might be even more wary of believing claims of inadvertence when you don't list something like tax refunds and you should have known about it. It's a simple question to ask, very straightforward, and it's a simple one to exempt or to tell the debtor you're going to have to give up.
Yeah, if you amend your exemptions after you got caught, then chances are good they may be denied.
Yeah. It's a lot easier to get it all right the first time, claim your exemptions, than it is to go back and convince someone that it was an accident. And it probably was. It probably was. I don't think that anybody in here is trying, you know, is willfully trying to hide these things from the judges, from the trustees, but you know, then you have to prove that you weren't willfully trying to do that.
Just going off of that, you want to make sure also that you are not prejudicing the creditors. So, I mean, In Re Myers, we looked at, was there a prejudice to creditors? Was there bad faith? And the trustee also has the burden of clear and convincing evidence. So we want to make sure, so it's looked at favorably on the debtor, of course, but we don't want to willfully, like Rob said, try and hide something. So.
I just wanted to briefly talk about lien avoidance and exemptions. That's one of the outlines provided on the website here. Under Section 522F, debtors are allowed to avoid certain liens if they impair exemptions. And 522F lays out what kind of exemptions they are. Judicial liens of a kind that is not, or that other than a kind that is specified in 523A5, without having to flip back and forth through the book, that means domestic support obligations. You're not going to be able to avoid a lien that arises from a domestic support obligation judgment. We can also avoid non-possessory, non-purchase money security interests in certain goods. And that's laid out in Section 522F1B. And that says household furnishings, household goods, wearing apparel, et cetera, et cetera. Please, at the bottom of the outline, there are some words in italics. Go ahead and cross that out. That was from an original version. What I had meant to say was that household goods does not mean everything in the house. So all it says is everything in the house. Cross that out. What I meant to say is that it does not include everything in the house. There are specific things that are listed, and you want to make sure, you know, for our clients, we won't be doing our job if we don't help them to the best of our ability, and that includes avoiding liens. Most of us are familiar with avoiding second and subsequent mortgages using adversary proceedings. Using 522F is a much quicker and easier way to avoid liens on certain items rather than having to do an adversary proceeding. Bear in mind, you do have to file the motion, make sure that notice is served properly so that the debtor, or so that the creditor rather, gets a chance to come in, object if they have a reason to. Also, specifically in the rules tied to this statute, and I'm not sure if it was Rule 4003 or 9014, it's listed in the rules. Oh, 4003D. So you have to file the motion has to be in accordance with Rule 9014, meaning notice has to be served properly, a notice of a hearing, or they have to be given a chance for a hearing on that. The creditor can object to the validity of the exemption that you're trying to say is impaired, even if it is more than 30 days after the 341 meeting of creditors, or after the conclusion of the meeting of creditors, rather. Normally, there's a 30-day window after the conclusion of the meeting of creditors when a creditor can object to exemptions and the validity of certain exemptions along with other things. In this case, waiting until after that point to file your motion to avoid the lien is not going to stop a creditor from objecting to the validity of the lien. Keep that in mind. So it's important to read the exact language of the statute, what it is you're trying to avoid the lien on, and be prepared for a creditor to show up in court. Now, in I think all but one of the lien avoidance motions that I've ever filed, no creditor has shown up. You just prepare the motion properly, lay out all the facts, say, listen, here it is under 522F. We can avoid this lien because it's a non-purchase money security interest. And they'll, you know, if they're savvy, they'll go and talk to a lawyer, and the lawyer will look at them and say, yeah, you can pay me if you want, but it's right here in 522F. It's laid out. You know, you have a lien on a couch and a TV and a DVD player. It's not going to fly. Now, the reason, the seeming reason why we're allowed to do this is because creditors have a little bit too much leverage on some of our clients when they have liens on household goods. They can say, hey, we're going to come in, you know, you want this loan, you're going to sign over these household goods to me, you know, beds, couches, you know, stove, your TV player, or your TV, your DVD player, all this stuff. And the debtor feels that, okay, I got to make these payments at, you know, 25% interest or whatever. A lot of these storefront loan places do charge very high interest rates, and they feel that they have to make payments to them or else they're going to lose all of their household goods and they're going to have an empty house. That's not the case, and that's the reason why we are allowed to avoid the lien, is so that our so the debtors can get a fresh start, you know, not a start from scratch. But pay attention, read through section 522F. The outline here, I've listed the statutory language in here. I also tell you what a judicial lien is. In Wisconsin, 806.15 specifically states that judgment liens are against real property of the debtor. Other states, it's different. They might be able to get a lien on anything owned by the debtor. In the state of Wisconsin, it's against real property. And you can use Section 522F to avoid those judicial liens.
Why would you? Why won't you just use the state statute after they get their discharge? You were talking about that there is no deadline to object to the exemptions when somebody's coming after you. And I recall one case where they were trying to avoid a judicial lien on this homestead property, and the issue became how much of the acreage surrounding the home was necessary. Mm-hmm. And these people had kind of subdivided it and had actually tried to sell parts. Well, that kind of suggests it wasn't really necessary if they're trying to sell it. But, I mean, it occurred to me later, and so I have a big decision about that. The case name is Olson, I think. But it occurred to me later, why did they try to avoid that judicial lien? Why didn't they wait, get their discharge, and then just use that section of the state statute to satisfy that judgment lien? Something
to... Honestly, I've never done it that way. I have done it through the bankruptcy code, and even then I haven't done it very often.
They may be in a 13,
if they are in a chapter 13, then we need to do something about it so that it is not, you know, so we don't have to address it through the plan as well. And that may be the reason why I haven't done it any other way, is because I primarily take care of the chapter 13. Right. I primarily take care of chapter 13, So, you know, I want to avoid that so it does not have to be addressed in the Chapter 13 plan and include that, that much more of an increase in the monthly payment. Mm-hmm. But certainly, I mean, under state law, you can take the lien off of the property as well.
Well, the homestead section says that it is not a lien on a homestead. So what you've got is a cloud on the title. You don't have an actual lien. Title companies are not going to make that fine distinction. They're just going to want to see the lien go away.
That's true,
Or the non-lien.
Or the non-lien, the cloud on the title, yes, the judgment that's out there.
And the other important part to remember here, I'm sorry, is just what impairs an exemption. 522F2A gives you the equation for how to tell if a lien impairs an exemption, and it's all written out here. But pay attention to that. Do the math on it. Make sure that you are properly adding things up, and don't take into account liens that have already been avoided or are not valid liens on the property. We can't include those in the equation. In fact, the code specifically says that you cannot, that liens that have already been avoided cannot be taken into account in your equation. But that's all in the outline there. Give it a read through. But it's all in section 522F.
Are you going to talk about Zhang?
Yeah.
That's in the marital and non-marital.
Yes. I'm sorry. We can get to that. Marital and non-marital property, important in our state because we are a marital property state. And so it's important to know if your client, if your client is married, or if there is marital property at all. And why is that? It's because section 541 of the code says that all legal or equitable interests of the debtor in property as of the commencement of the case they come into the bankruptcy estate. Being a marital property state, all marital property the debtor has an interest in. Because the debtor has an interest in it, it needs to become part of the estate. And you need to list it in the schedules. Then, once it's listed in the schedules, we work on exempting that. Let's see here. Okay, so in Ray Zhang, it is a Judge Kelly case, and it's a case where there's a non-filing spouse, where the husband chose to file bankruptcy and the wife did not. There are a lot of reasons why that might happen, and we run across it often in our practices. One spouse files, the other doesn't. Well, what do we have to include? Once we've listed that stuff, what exemptions can we take to make sure that property is protected? Once that case had been filed, the debtor chose to use the federal exemptions. The trustee filed a motion to compel turnover of certain assets. Those assets included two parcels of real estate, a piece of real estate in Kansas, and a piece of real estate in the state of Wisconsin, as well as a truck and a car. Now, this is where it's important to determine what is marital property and what is not. So, to do that, we need to know what the determination date is. Chapter 766 of the Wisconsin State Code is what lays out marital property. Now, the determination date is what determines when marital property starts. I guess that's a poor way of saying it, but you have the determination date is. The later of January 1st, 1986, or the date that the debtors both became domiciled in the state of Wisconsin, or the date that the debtors were married. Now, any property that was acquired before that date does not change for the most part. So in this case, the property purchased in Kansas used to be their homestead. It was purchased prior to their move to Wisconsin. It was titled, as joint tenants and not tenants in common. Because that property was purchased prior to the determination date, section 766.318 of the Wisconsin Code, again this is in the outline there, states that the classification and ownership rights of property acquired before the determination date does not change simply because they are now living in Wisconsin and subject to marital property laws. As such, debtor had to list the interest in the property. Now, and the judge could do a better job of stating it than I could, but the interest in the property is an undivided interest.
The interest in the
marital property.
Yeah.
It is an undivided interest. So only the interest of the debtor would be included as part of the bankruptcy estate. One half of the equity of the house, therefore, was part of the estate. Remember, this is not marital property. It was purchased, it was acquired prior to the determination date. As such, the one half of any equity in the property is property of the estate, and the debtor would have to exempt that portion.
No, all of it was property of the estate, of the marital property, not the Kansas property. We're talking about the marital property. All the marital property comes into the estate, and in order to have an exemption on a particular undivisible asset, then the debtor had to be able to exempt the entire asset. Judge Kelly found that in Zhang. There are two cases in the Western District, Vanderhei and Griffin, where Judge Utchig said the same thing. In one involved the federal exemptions, one involved the state exemptions, but it didn't matter. In order to exempt the non-divisible asset, it was didn't make sense to have an exemption because it was a non-divisible asset and the debtor's interest was also non-divisible. Debtor got to exempt the entire asset. In the Wald case, W-A-L-D case in Texas, Judge Clark said, basically, I'm paraphrasing now, McGarrity meant well, but, I mean, he cited some of my, some stuff that I've written, because I do hold with that particular concept that doesn't make sense not to be able to take the entire asset because you've got an interest in the entire asset as a community property interest. But he said, no, you only get one half. Since we've now got those two lines of published cases, stay tuned. There may be other community property states where they will take the Wald rationale and say the debtor can only exempt the debtor's interest, which is only a one half interest, so you got to sell the asset and only exempt that. In at least Judge Utchik's two decisions and the Zhang decision, which are of course right, the debtor, in order to have any exemption at all, you have to be able to take the entire asset.
So read the Zhang decision. That is, it is important. And as I said, the judges would do a much better job explaining it than I could. Clearly.
Sorry for jumping in.
I thought the highlight of my month was seeing the Eagles at Summerfest the other night, but actually it was having Judge McGarrity see I got a marital property issue.
There you go.
I don't know how difficult that is. I want to thank you so much for presenting. We're running out of time here again. Please come back in August. We're going to have discussions on pretrial, best practices, a big panel, and we hope you can all make it back. Thanks again.
Thank you. Thank you.